Namaste and welcome everyone to the Wednesday 10 p.m. show, which is co-hosted by me and Shri Vibhuti Jha. And today we are going to talk about global economy and also Indian economy in relation to the global economy. And we have two economists well known to the Jaipur Dialogues audience, Vijay Sardana Ji, and we have also got Anurag Singh Ji from Chicago. So two of us from India and two of them from the United States. So I'll start with Vijay Ji. Vijay Ji, what was that sweet little visit to Saudi Arabia by Joe, old Joe? And he didn't really look very happy at the end of it.
Sanjay Ji, first of all, good evening to all of you. Can you see my, can you hear and view my broadcast?
We can hear you, but your picture is frozen.
We can hear you, but your picture is frozen for the moment. Not too worried.
So, you can please continue.
See, first of all, good evening to all of you. Good morning, wherever you are located on this planet. After this Ukraine crisis, if you look at, there is a need to create lobbies which can support or come in line with the, you know, particular ideology. And everybody knows that right now the crisis of fuel or the fuel led inflation around the world is biggest concern for Western world, whether it is Europe, it is America or their allies. And two important sources of commodities, Ukraine and Russia, are at war. It means almost like you can say 30-40% of wheat is at stake, and almost a major supplier of all forms of energy, whether it is crude, gas or coal, which is coming from Russia to Europe, is now no more, I will say that, in a comfortable zone, because now prices are not under the dictate of Western world. So they have to look for someone who can help them in reducing these boiling prices, especially of energy. And that's why, as we all know, that Saudi Arabia is one of the major players. Other major players are also not in good terms with America, like Venezuela and Iran. So ultimately, they are left with only one big player, that is Saudi Arabia. And I think that was the visit, because after Khashoggi's, murder in Turkey, things were not very comfortable. So it was high time that there should be some cooling off effect between the, you know, US and the Saudi relations. So that was the pretext under which Joe Biden took time out from busy schedule and visited Saudi Arabia. So this is where one can start looking at, will it help or not? I think that's a secondary thing which you can discuss later.
Okay. Anurag Ji, did it help?
Yeah. So, first of all, namaskar to all the listeners. Yeah. I think even on the channels which are very favorable to the president here, to the Democratic Party, the view is that it did not help. So, look, there is $100 billion. $100 million barrels per day of oil that is needed in the globe. About 35% of that is consumed by US. US of late has lost about 15-20% of its refining capacity. The idea was that this capacity cannot be substituted. I mean, the companies can't increase production in a short term, at least for 1 or 2 years. So the idea from Biden's side was that Saudi Arabia can pump more oil so that US can kind of cool down the inflation a bit a little. So obviously that did not help. I don't really understand, Sanjay Ji, even the politics of it, or the whole imagery of the whole visit, because it was very clear that Saudi Arabia, why would Saudi Arabia oblige and reduce the prices of raw material, which is basically their source of income, right? It is like me asking you to pay for 10-15% of your income to me. That's not going to happen.
Right. Vibhuti Ji?
Yeah, I mean, Saudi Arabia visit of President Biden was a flop. It didn't achieve any goal. Actually, MBS told him in no uncertain terms that we no longer have any additional capacity to produce more. Having said that, what is also important is that, you know, it was a very weird visit. It's like Joe Biden had cleared the pitch for any conversation with Putin or MBS or others because he calls ugly names. He uses bad words as a president. It's even worse because he's the president of the United States to call MBS a killer, you know, decrying the country for what it is. And then you go to him to talk. It's like, it's worse than Rahul Gandhi and you know, Sonia Gandhi calling Modi names. And Modi will tell them, come back again, milte rahiye. So this is, it's a very pathetic situation that when you queer the pitch, then your conversation, you can't forget that. MBS cannot forget. You saw the body language. It was a stern look in his face. Oh, you are the guy who is coming to me to ask for oil. You are, why don't you produce yourself? Why are you asking me, calling me a killer, and then coming to me for oil? It's not done. But it's more important than that. What I'm seeing here is that the socialist measures of President Biden has forced the former chairman of Morgan Stanley, Stephen Roach, to say that the U.S. living standards are about to be squeezed as never before. This is important. I mean, people are shouting about high price rise in India. I mean, we are not shouting here, but we are paying double the price of gas. Milk, eggs, everything has doubled up here. But because we are able to absorb it somehow or the other, because remember, the food bill of a typical American household earner is about 8 to 9%. In India, it is more than 40 to 50%, the food bill itself of the earning capacity. So we are still able to absorb the food costs. But it is staring glaringly in our face right now. So, you know, it led to another person making a very profound statement. Ray Dalio, the world's largest hedge fund manager, made a statement that no empire lasts forever. You know, and the other one was a dangerous one by Stephen Druckenmiller, who said that this is the biggest redistribution of wealth from the middle class and the poor to the rich forever. This is Druckenmiller, who was working with George Soros and was part of the team that bet on British pound. So you are looking at a scenario where people who are, as Anurag, you very rightly pointed out, even the media and the people who are supportive of Biden, they are critical of the whole situation right now. And that's why you had Taiwan, you have all these kind of things going on, was to distract the attention from the upcoming 2022 election in a few months from now.
Okay, so that's like a true Republican. Just to inform our other guests, Shri Vibhuti Jha is contesting on a Republican ticket for the New York State Assembly this November. Right. So right. What you got was, I mean, it can be called a tainted Republican perspective, if I might add.
But tainted, but truthful.
So, coming back to Vijayji, now we have this global perspective right now, and according to me, the global economy is in doldrums. What do you think?
Obviously, see, if you look into the price trend across the commodities, especially, you know, the energy, which is the foundation of any economic activity, all energy prices are somewhere, you know, 80 to 120, and in some cases, maybe 200% up. Obviously, if the fundamental or the baseline is up, it is bound to impact every possible activity in economic activity in any country, in any economy. And then you had a very classic case of Ukraine-Russia war, which is one side. In last 20 years, we were promoting globalization via WTO, that why you are producing everything, depend in the world market, we will feed you better, because it will be cheaper, better quality, etc. And then you landed up with the embargoes, whether it is sanctions and whatever you call it. Then you leave everybody into high and dry on the supply side. And then, unfortunately, we had a natural disaster created by man-made over-anxiety, that is COVID. So this is, we have to also factor in. And now supplemented by Taiwan. So one after another, I think we are actually trying to tell the people that get out of globalization, start focusing Atmanirbharta or, you know, self-reliance. Because the world is becoming more and more unsure of what they can offer. And this is where I think going to put a lot of pressure on the global supply chains. And that will further make life more complex, whether it is economically, even strategically. So what my way of looking at is that all the mess which is happening here, somewhere, I think one common factor is America. So where it is, you know, crisis of fuel, whether it is crisis of Ukraine, whether it is Taiwan, or even if you look into the, all these monsters directly or indirectly, who created China? It's American companies. Who is funding the war of China against America is actually American companies. So this is where what is happening around the world. And we, if dependent on so-called globalization philosophy, which actually European wants, it is not as great help to America, but more of European phenomena, because European markets are fully saturated. They don't have population. Their production facilities are in place. Population is declining. Being a developed country, the consumption is almost saturated. And the more interventions of technology, robotics, IT, etc., if it is going to improve the productivity and production, where they will sell. So they have to look at globalization or the world market. And if they don't sell it, they have to offer subsidy, which will make their economy further worse. So this is where one has to understand that we are classically in a very phased, you can say, decentralization from a globalization to localization or at the best FTAs. And FTAs in regional blocks. And this is where the China is also eyeing that new game. So I said in 2020, in the beginning, that we are entering into new global, you know, world order. India will be beneficiary if we play our cards right. But the one of the biggest sufferers is Europe. And Europe is dependent on America for foreign policy and diplomacy and everything. And then you have two big monsters, Russia and China, to counter them. Let's see how this chess is going to play.
Okay. Anuragi, your take?
Yeah. So, Sanjayji, let's understand there are about four or five mega trends which are now playing in the global economy, right? One is this geopolitics, right? We all know Ukraine war happened, but I think what it did is it kind of crystallized the whole world into a kind of now a bipolar world. So Cold War is back, we like it or not. In some form, it is back. United Nations has been a failure. The five countries with veto powers, now three of them are one side, and China and Russia clearly are on the other side. Most of the developed market wanted to take countries like us, you know, they wanted us to take sides. We did not take, and I think that was the right move. But clearly, Cold War is back. World is divided. It will create more conflicts, and we should be ready for it. And obviously, you know, we can discuss the visit to Taiwan, but I think that also is a further indication that the world is very divided now. So expect anything. Second is, world was already coming out of a COVID, post-COVID life, where, you know, COVID really caused a lot of easy money policy. What central banks did was, especially in the developed market and also in the emerging market, they reduced the cost of money, which is the interest rate. In developed market, the rates were mostly zero or slightly negative, right? So that was one backdrop. What it did is that it increased the asset prices, because if the money is cheaper, people buy more houses, more stock markets, Bitcoin, you call it, right? All the speculation goes around. So I think the economy was trying to come out of that, because you have to eventually inflate those bubbles. So second is that mega trend. It is still underway. And that's why you see the banks are raising the rates. And as they are raising the rates, the asset prices across the globe are cooling down. So that's also another trend. Markets also might face correction, which is happening across Indian markets. Somehow is resilient. We can discuss why. But broadly, markets in US and across the world are now cooling down, which also is leading to asset collapse, which means that wealth creation will not happen because money is now relatively expensive. Third is the inflation. So what the easy money did is that across the world, when there is more money available and much easily and lending is very quick, it really results in everybody's capacity getting increased to buy things. And what it eventually does is that it increases the inflation in the market because there are only as many goods. And if more money chases more goods, it causes inflation. So I think globally, I would say the markets, society in general, the economies, eventually they're all fighting these three mega trends. One is the geopolitical risks, which will constantly continue to be a backdrop for a couple of years, which will keep the commodity prices at risk in some sense or the other. Second is the easy money policy is ending and the inflation is pervasive. Banks will try and fight it. If banks try and fight it, it is generally not good for the economy because what it does is that if the interest rates rise, companies invest less money, they shunt more people to maintain profitability, which causes more unemployment. So ultimately, it might lead to a recession also, which might be global as well, right? And obviously, while India is doing very well, if India were to grow at 9%, India can't grow at 9% because the global economy is slowing down. So we might possibly grow at 6.5-7%. So broadly, these are the 3-4 mega trends which are in play. And Sanjay, I think for the next 2 years, I think we will have to live with that.
If I may, I mean, my inquiry will be with both of you here. Is that, as you said, that India can't be isolated. We are talking about the free trade arrangements. But at the same time, we are living in a remarkably interconnected world right now on a no-choice basis. Technology has broken the barrier. Everybody's is so interdependent and so ever reliant on the other. Look at India itself. It's so reliant on energy supplies from everywhere, its energy needs. But like global projections were there, India is supposed to knock 2022 May 7.4% higher than most of the countries. Where is that growth projections coming from? Citibank chief, Bloomberg, everybody has said that India will survive recession. And in the US, we are suffering both inflation and recession, both at the same time. And if US is going to be dominating this conversation, how do you see the climate change impact, the budgeting that has happened by the Biden administration affect all of us? Because that sets into motion. The money was not there, now the money is there. How will US force its geopolitical power on everybody else?
Okay. Let me take the first shot on this. So I'm sure there are certain trick questions in between because Vibhuti ji knows some of the answers therein, but I'll still take a shot at this. So one is the interdependent, interconnected world, right? Which, there's this interesting quote by, and I might be forgetting one part of it, where people are talking about Germany, that Germany tried to outsource its energy to Russia, its army to NATO and foreign policy to somebody else. And then actually, eventually they realized that nothing worked. And now they're paying the price of it, right? So I think the world is interdependent. And of course, look, India is net importer of oil, so we don't have a choice. Energy is something that we have to import. And that's why I think I always say that broadly a difference between a Saudi Arabia and a Pakistan is that they have oil and they were not born with oil. Pakistan was not born with oil. But I think, be that as it may, I think India is stronger because of its domestic economy. Look, 70% of all the economies are consumption-based. US economy, 70% is consumption-based. So is India. As long as the population of the country largely is consuming, it allows a country to be self-dependent and less reliant on exports. I think what we see the problem happening with some of these countries like Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, is that they were too reliant either on foreign debt or on exports or on tourism. And I think if you're over-dependent and major proportion of your income, especially foreign income in dollars, comes from one of these two, three things, then you are more dependent on the global economy. In India, that's not the case. Our foreign debt is very limited. It's about less than 15%, 10% of our overall debt. We are reliant on exports, but our exports are services driven, which are actually doing well in this environment. And domestic economy, although I think there are pockets of improvement, we can improve a lot. There is a lot of room. But I think we have a rock solid base which allows us to grow at 7%. China is growing at 3.5%, but we should not forget that China grew at more than 7-8% for three decades. So I think they can take a bit of a rest. We can't. And I think we got to grow at 7%. So broadly, that's the answer to the first one. Biden's, be it Biden or I think in a increasingly bipolar world, I think the U.S., US's ability to influence global policy is getting restricted compared to the earlier scenario, right? That's a well-acknowledged fact. And for some reasons, also, US wanted to pull out from the affairs of the global economy. The only problem here is that the dollar appreciates a lot. So I think in any recessionary environment, there is a flight to safety. So from all the emerging markets, and we see this happening even in the Indian markets, that foreign capital leaves and comes back home. When there is a crisis in the world, you come back home. So everything is converging to US dollars. US dollar is appreciating, which makes our exports little expensive. That's the only problem, I would say, you know, which is for the countries like India or even other countries. And that's why you see some of the countries are also failing because they just can't pay up the export bill, which creates a balance of payment crisis. That's my kind of limited take on this.
No, it was a very good take, and there were no trick questions. The question is, because we all want to test what we are talking about, how valid and how close to the reality we are. You know, that's what is important. Yeah, yeah. So the next thing that I wanted to also ask, that there is only one person in the world who practices free market economy, and that is Arvind Kejriwal. He gives everything free to everybody.
And that whole freebie discussion has come.
That's a new one.
So this come is, about this because of him. And this, not a day too soon. I think we must credit Kejriwal. If he had not crossed all red lines, probably this Supreme Court would not have issued notice on that petition.
So America, again, you will say that I have spoken like a true Republican. I would be saying the thing whether I was a Republican or not. So the freebies are the ones which hurt the most, any economy. Their capacity to pay eventually matters. But Sarji, main aapse ek puchna chahta tha ki ye jo climate ka jo budget pura lagaya hai Biden ne, what will be the, you know, there is a very lot of confusion about this. The school of thought that believes that climate change investment is required to save the world. But there is other school of thought, and there are some very good people on the other side, that our priorities are wrong. Because it's going to, I mean, if Stephen Druckenmiller is saying that this is the biggest transfer of wealth happening, we have to take it with a pinch of salt, our seriousness both. Because, it has impact on, communities. Who will sacrifice more? Mr. Biden has already told America to sacrifice, be ready to sacrifice to protect democracy in Ukraine. So we are already paying the price of sacrifice. How long are the normal people, the ordinary human being who suffers so much on all these elements, always called upon to sacrifice, tolerate this?
May I have to come in?
Yes, please.
Yeah, sure. See, Biden sir, or even the Western world, I'm a little cynical of, you can say, on their, agenda items very often. Because see, every time it is like a flavor of the month. I know there are many moral issues, there are many technical issues. One has to look at it. I'm not denying that climate change is not important for the world. It is very much important. But the fact of the matter is that when it suits, there is a climate change. There is a new set of rules for the world trade. There are new set of certifications. There are new guidelines, new enforcements, because it suits them. But when situation like Ukraine comes, they don't mind starting again their thermal power plants. They are again going back to nuclear energy. Then everything, the so-called dirty, becomes good. So what we have to look at is, see, end of the day, we have to appreciate two important things. I always say that the world is actually moves around the economy, and politics is as a facilitator. And then you use diplomacy as tools to open those gates. So what we have to look in the whole process is, when Europe knows it very well that because of their cost of production is high and they cannot compete in the world market, you have to create many non-tariff barriers for the world so that the cost difference, the cost of manufacturing between China, India, Europe, and America actually becomes, you know, at par. That is the whole desire. So sometimes you will find issue of deforestation. Sometimes you will find issue of child labor. Sometimes you will find issue of human rights. Sometimes you will find something else. And from last decade, it is going on as climate change. Fact of the matter here comes up is again and again, if you are so much concerned about climate change, then what the commitments you make, and you know it very well, that developing economy or countries like India may not have the best of the technology to mitigate the climate change impact. It takes time to do a research and come out, and it is a resource intensive activity because you have to go for research and come out with better options. If they have better technologies and if they are really worried about climate change, why they are not helping other countries in reducing the carbon and water footprint? Why they are not doing it? They simply give sermons, they do seminars, but they don't help technically. And when you go for technological options, then they say it is premium, it is patented, you cannot use. So there is a serious, I will say that it is a, like a flavor of the month. And that is where the issue comes up is that one has to question this, you know, seriousness for the cause. But they have to use the terminology which I mentioned, including global, you know, warming and climate change, etc., just to take a higher moral ground. And when it comes to their own problems, like Ukraine crisis, Russia is stopping the supplies, they don't mind starting their own coal-based thermal power plants because it suits them now. Now there is no more global agenda for climate change. And if they really wanted globalization, even WTO to survive, then why they created sanctions against Russia? So that is what one has to look at, is that what they are preaching and what they are doing, I think there is no connect. Ultimately, it is self-centered approach. If climate change suits me, I will talk about it. If global warming suits me, I will talk about it. If globalization suits me, I will talk about it. If these things are not in favor of me or my political ideology or political agenda, then I may say this can take back seat right now. Maybe it's human rights. Maybe it is sovereignty. Maybe it is something else. So you come out with another rule book and you say, okay, now this rule book is valid for next 3 years. Let us address this first and then we'll go back to another rule book. The tendency of Western world to decide the agenda for the world is happening from last 50 years. Unfortunately, what you are seeing now, that theater which was earlier set, staged by Western world, is that theater of action is now shifting towards Asia. And that is making Western world extremely uncomfortable. And that's why if you see that today, if President of America has to walk into Saudi Arabia and pleading for the fuel supplies, and nobody is listening. In Taiwan, nobody is listening. In Ukraine, nobody is listening to them. And whole focus is on Asia. Because action and economic growth is in Asia, as I mentioned again. Europe is fully saturated. There is no more opportunity to invest because you can't make more money. Markets are highly saturated. America, saturated market. Africa, limited purchasing power. Latin America, geographically, is far away from the world. Where is the growth? Growth is in Asia. And where is the profitability? It is in Asia. And two important powers, China and India, which are in the center of action. One side you have East Asia, on the other side you have Middle East, and down you have Africa, is strategically located. On the other side, you have a China, but because China is highly ambitious and you don't want to tolerate anything by China because that is going to change the leadership of US and the Western world. So you want to contain that. So it is actually a test case now how the Western powers are going to maneuver in the changing world order. And let me tell you, it is not going to be easy because all the rule books, all the definitions, all the formula so far were created by the Western institutions and leaderships to prove that Western world is superior to rest of the world. But now that equation is changing, and that is making things uncomfortable. So climate change is also part of that. Fuel supplies are part of that. Even if you see that India will not be part of recession for simple reason, because India has huge 140 crore population in-house, which is underfed, underutilized, unsaturated. So there is enough scope to absorb as much money as you dump here. And then this market has democracy, so you can't even question, like China. This economy is improving its fundamentals, that is infrastructure and regulatory environments, ease of doing business. You cannot question, you cannot complain. In IT, it is all over connected, so you can't complain even that. So what you have to complain? You have to complain some fringe elements that you can't do this and that, but growing within India, if I say that growing self-reliance agenda, whether it is technology, industry, employment, and other issues, I think there is no option. But the Western companies, those who want to make money, they have to come to India or they have to go to China. Now they have to choose between the two.
That's quite heartening coming from the two experts here. Vibhuti ji, how about shifting to India now?
Why not? I already brought Arvind Kejriwal and the free market economy. So the point is, India ka to jahan tak sawal hai, but there is a very important point, our friend has pointed out here, the institutional framework and his cynicism or skepticism regarding the Western institutions' flavor of the month. That is something that we must talk about it, because India can't be isolated from that entire thing. And that's what is important. Unless and until we begin to write our own agenda, unless and until India begins to write its own agenda, people take you for granted, so long as we are following somebody's agenda. So a question, this is an inquiry that came to my mind on the subject matter of climate change, population growth, and resource utilization. This happened actually 5 years ago when Linda Grattan, London Business School professor of management, and I were sharing a platform with the Economist conference. And they were discussing the global growth in population from 6 billion to 8 billion and then to 12 billion. So the question came about, what is the optimum size of population for the world, for the entire world? Because after all, we all consume Earth's resources. And then they were talking about the replacement theory of population to contain. How valid is that theory is my fundamental question. Because by a quirk of nature, some freak thing happens and world's population shrinks by 2 billion, I think the world's climate problem will be solved. Because eventually we are creating pressure. Our consumption is creating pressure on Earth's resources. And that's what is actually the root cause. I lived in two air-conditioned cities in India, Pune and Bangalore. Today, temperature hits 40 degrees. I use fan for 3 or 4 times in a year when I lived there. Today, you can't live without air conditioning. But what is the reason for that? Is it the excess urbanization, concentration of industries, lopsided development and models like Bangalore got 7 PSUs came to Bangalore that created the entire pressure on the Bangalore city. Today's traffic is horrible, but the population growth today is Silicon Valley ban gaya. So what is advantage one time is a disadvantage at another time. We need to focus on that. This replacement of population theory and population control, which is actually the reason for Earth's climate change, because we have to do things to bring comfort to people, consume more. How valid is that theory?
See, the point here comes up is all these problems started when you had a wrong parameters for measurement of success.
That's right. That's right.
The problem comes up is that if you consume more energy, means you are more developed.
That's right.
Look at Human Development Index. What is per capita electricity consumption? That will decide, give you extra mark. More you consume power, more you are developed. More you burn calories in the name of fuel, you are more developed. More cars a society has, more developed you are. What was happening? And that is what I'm trying to say, that we adopted a wrong, distorted parameter of success in this world. Because that was the only way tangible things which you started measuring, whether it is fuel, whether it is power, whether it is, area of the house, all those things which actually led to overconsumption, overexploitation, And today we are talking in the form of a global warming. First thing, if world has to do is change your success parameter from so-called tangible polluting parameters, maybe to more sensible parameters. It means, will you change the Human Development Index report? That is first thing. Because your parameters are disturbed. Your parameters are wrong. Classic example, let me tell you. The top 10 parameters of the world, the top 10 countries which are on Human Development Index are basically Scandinavian countries. The fact is, maximum mental health care budget in the world is in Scandinavia. If you are so developed, then you should be happy. Why your society is having maximum health care, mental health care budget? It means your parameters may be giving you physical comfort, but mentally you are not happy. Either you are in depression, you have a suicidal tendency, or you have some other social and other problems in the society. So is this development, even if you are in the number 10, number 1, number 5 of global Human Development Index agenda, but you are not mentally happy? Is this the human development? So what we are trying to say in this process is, I think the West has to learn now when it comes to, you know, what is human development? It is not always physical, materialistic, even spiritual, maybe mental peace, maybe meditation should be one of the criteria when it comes to Human Development Index. But you will not find anything which is actually bringing peace to human society, maybe which will bring more cordial interface between human and nature as part of the development index. We will not. And that is the problem, that we, when we create a wrong parameters to measure a success, then you may call it, I'm closer to the parameter of success. But fact is, in the process, you have destroyed the world. And this is where, when it comes to the current political scenario, I can always go to Taiwan and say, yes, this is my success parameter that I visited a territory which you were saying it is bad. But outcome, you have created one more turbulence in the global peace. So point here comes up is that unless we relook into the so-called success and development parameters of the world, and UN is actually becoming nothing but a club. You just go have fun in those nice sightseeing locations and come back without any tangible outcomes, except signing some on dotted lines. That's all. So point here comes up is, I think high time when we have to relook into whether the parameters which are imposed on us, are they, when it comes to climate change, are they helping climate change or they are destabilizing climate change? If they are destabilizing climate sustainability, then I think those parameters need change.
Sanjay ji?
Yeah.
I mean, I would want the population concept, Anurag ji, you also to comment on that, please.
Sure.
That's also a burning topic in India as well, because India's every challenge in India is a 1.3 billion people problem. Anything you implement, it is a big problem of people.
Correct. So let's take, I think, two, three points. Let me. So first of all, I like it the way Vijay and Sardana, I was thinking what to say. So Sardana ji has put it the way that the developed market or the developed world cannot decide the agenda for emerging markets. I think that's largely true. However, alongside, I think there is a bit of a conflict that we countries like us sometimes face. When I say countries like us, as in I'm saying India, which is that we want to be politically free, but we want to be economically dependent, right? And when I say economically dependent, we want all the technology, we want the capital flight, we want the dollars to come in, we want the capital markets to grow, because you know that creates prosperity. So there is a bit of a balance, and that these countries, the leeway that these countries have, the developed market has, is that they say, look, all the technology and the capital is going to come from our side. And if that is going to come, there is a cost to pay, because then you need to make your institutions according to, you know, the way we desire them to be, right? And there might be, you know, I understand environment is a non-tariff kind of a barrier, but and it is misused across, but it is, you know, that's why it is designed to be. So that's a bit of a conflict. So we have to keep a balance that unless we become like a maybe of a size of China or something like that, you know, that size of an economy can have its own wishes and can kind of dictate to the world. But even there are dependencies between US and China where, you know, very few people are kind of willing to break that link. So there is this dependency. So we do find some middle ground. So there is no political independence without an economic or a capital independence, right? That's where we get limited. Therein comes the energy as well. There's also no independence, political independence, unless you are importing energy from Saudi Arabia or Gulf countries or OPEC and all of that. Because obviously, you know, if they make noises, we saw those examples. If they make noises, you have to kind of abide. So that's the kind of a linkage between dependencies. I think in terms of the other values like freedom of speech and democracy and all of that, I completely agree that I think there is too much importance accorded to some of these Western institutions which rank the countries. And then even in a democracy like India, if it were not the Modi government, they say it's India is, you know, a diverse democracy. But if Modi gets elected, they say it's kind of authoritarian democracy, right? That's the term that's being used to describe. Now, I don't know what decides an authoritarian democracy. If a leader wins a convincing majority two times or three times in a row, is, I would say it's a healthy democracy, but somehow Western media sees it as an authoritarian democracy. But they decide anyways. And I think that we should kind of completely shun those rankings. I love the way the current government in India responds to some of these overtures that, you know, we really don't need certificates of approval from some of these authorities. Fourth is, I think the look at China as an example, right? I look, population, and coming to your point, Pune, Bangalore, I think to a point, we have to see economy of the size of US, 25 trillion, is all about 330 million people, right? With about 1.4 billion people, it's kind of very obvious that we cannot have that level of standard for all the people. So I think beyond a point, I think we have grown to a size which is a bit too many. But on the other side, I think if we just kind of spin this a bit, look at China, which exemplifies that, you know, a lot can be done with this population, because ultimately limitation kaha hai? Limitation wahi hai that you have, whether you have worthwhile jobs to do for all of your people in the country. And that's the productivity. If everybody is productive, then we can be four times of US. But if we have the same productivity spread across 1.4 billion people, then it's a bit of a problem. And then our GDP just looks like 3.5 trillion and not 25 trillion. So it's a conundrum, but I think to a point, I would say it has become an obstacle. We possibly can't find so many worthwhile, highly productive jobs for so many people. But I think we need to learn their good examples from China here, that how it creates a competitive capitalism amongst the states within China and within the governments, that they compete to get the government resources. China is politically a communist country, but it is extremely ruthlessly capitalist. And I think we need to embrace that. The stigma on capitalism and getting rich in India, I think that also needs to go. And that kind of adds up to the complexity of problems that we face. Those are my two cents broadly, I would say.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And I think we need to go to the questions, audience questions now. So before that,